Loud, BBC News.
In an hour from now on The World Tonight, Sean Lay hears about the first major international police operation to catch people operating sites on the most unregulated part of the internet, the dark web. Although there have been arrests in some of the 17 countries involved in the raids, he'll be hearing how an arms race has developed between the criminals and the law enforcers. That's on The World Tonight at 10 o'clock. Before then, on Radio 4, Professor Cathy Willis, the Director of Science at the Royal Botanic Gardens Kew, presents the final omnibus edition of her new history of our changing relationship with plants. Plants from roots to riches.
Amble along the plant beds here at Kew, and you'd be forgiven for thinking that the plants are arranged in this order because they look nice. They certainly do look attractive. But that's not the whole story. Richard Barley, Director of Horticulture, is here with me. Richard, you and your team tend these beds known as the order beds. These have a very distinctive purpose, don't they?
Well, this area was laid out by Kew's director, William Hooker, in the 1840s with a series of beds that he called the herbaceous grounds to show the classification and relationships of different plants. And then by the time his son became director, Joseph Hooker, and he teamed up with George Bentham, they came up with a modified version, if you like, of that plant classification system, the Bentham-Hooker version. And so the beds were reordered according to that notion of understanding.
The process they used to work out how plants were related had all the beauty of simplicity. They looked at them. Compare visible details or morphology, like shape, colour, size, layout, and the number of various plant parts, and you could work out who was related to whom. It was a brilliant system, but inevitably it had its limitations. However, it provided an important framework that taxonomists continue to build on and argue over for the next century. But it wasn't until the 1990s, with the opportunities offered by the new science of DNA sequencing, that the genetic roadmap to flowering plants, or angiosperms, was developed. For the first time, this mapping allowed classification to be made at a molecular level rather than just based on appearance. Scientists began by sequencing a single gene common to all flowering plants to see how much change in the DNA there was between different species. By doing so, they could begin to infer how closely related they were. This work was led here at Kew by Professor Mark Chase, keeper of the Jodrell Laboratory, and as he explains, the results were somewhat unexpected.
We had no real expectation that this would lead to a change of classification. It was a big experiment. It was 500 sequences of a single gene that covered most angiosperms, the gene that takes CO2 out of the atmosphere and pulls it into the photosynthetic pathway that leads to production of sugars. So it's an absolutely essential gene for anything that undergoes photosynthesis. And once the field started to move into this high gear, so to speak, it really went quickly. And the technology that was developed for the Human Genome Project, the sequencers, are then available to us, and we could produce all these data. And most of us were surprised when we found out that the things that we thought should be in one family were actually interdigitated with things that were thought to be in other families.
But the new techniques also allowed scientists to begin to see new connections between plants, which appearance alone could never have suggested. Knowing that they were now onto something, an international group of scientists known as the Angiosperm Plant Phylogeny Group, or the APG Group, was formed. Reassuringly, they found that at the highest level, Bentham and Hooker's layout here at the order beds had been largely right.
What we found when we compared, for example, the molecular results at the family level, orchids, legumes, you know, these kinds of things, it's the major categories. About 87% of the families based on morphology were found in the DNA-based trees. So at the family level, there wasn't a great deal of discordance. Orchids are found, you know, as a nice group in the DNA-based results, and the same with legumes, and you know, you can go down the long list, and they were there. Above the level of family, things were wildly different. So, for example, the really classic one that everybody cites as being almost uncomprehensible is the relationship between the Protea family, Proteaceae, the plane tree family, Platanaceae, and the lotus family, Nelumbinaceae. Nelumbo, or the lotus, what had always been considered to be a water lily. It looks like a water lily. And the plane tree is a wind-pollinated terrestrial tree. You wouldn't expect them to have much in common. And the Proteaceae, highly specialized flowers ranged into heads, nothing else like them in the angiosperms, and these three came out together. And when the graduate student that was working on this project came to me with these results, I said, well, I think somebody mixed up some tubes here someplace along the way. You better go back and repeat the experiments. He repeated it and got the same result. Of course, we've now done it with lots of genes, and these three families come out every single time as a group. And the most that we can say that they share is a particular type of wax on the surface of the leaves. But that's about the best we can do. We still really lack the capacity to say why it is these three families come together. But it's such a consistent answer in the DNA results that we more or less just accept it.
So Richard Bolley, as a result of this work, presumably some changes had to go on in terms of where things were placed in the order beds.
Groups of plants were moved around a little like markers on a chessboard. So for example, roses and nettles, which had been quite far apart, were moved close to each other because it turned out that they were closely related according to their DNA.
So we now can see roses and nettles next to each other, can we, in the order beds?
Correct. Although, hopefully not too many nettles in this area because they are something of a weed, but you get the idea.
It's no exaggeration to say that taxonomy had finally found its true backbone, a structure not just based on what it looked like, but also its DNA fingerprint. Historian Jim Endersby.
For a long time, botany generally, but particularly areas like classification, really looked like something left over from the 19th century. And I think the APG, with a big team of international workers, each using the same technology, sequencing DNA, analysing it with the same computer software and so on, allowed a scale of collaboration that really put classification on a different footing than it had ever been on before. So it's a very exciting moment in many ways.
DNA sequencing allowed scientists not just to classify plants into family groups, but also to ask different questions of plants. In particular, it offered a molecular backbone to underpin and sometimes challenge the evolutionary relationships previously only seen in the fossil record, to work out how groups of plants were related to each other through time. A molecular evolutionary tree of life, if you like, with the discipline of genetics enabling new questions to be asked.
How we classify is always a product of why we classify. You can see that when you look at Hooker, working in a big metropolitan herbarium with the imperial project very much in mind. You can see that if you compare him with Colenso, the New Zealand missionary with whom he corresponded in the 19th century, splitting species, looking at the rich local detail that he wants to understand what's going on in his backyard. He has a different kind of project and therefore a different classification. And that's repeated over and over again around the world throughout history. And in a sense, modern classification takes the evolutionary lineage as the goal of classification. In the 19th century, of course, the pattern of affinity was the goal. The evolutionary story was the explanation for it. So there has been an interesting shift, even though evolution has remained a common part of the story.
Do these evolutionary or so-called phylogenetic relationships matter? Is plant family history merely an exercise in detective work of interest only to blue sky researchers? Gwil Lewis is head of legumes at Kew and curates a plant family with members ranging from tiny aquatic plants to huge 60-foot trees. He explains how a detailed knowledge of their family relationships at genus and species level is of immense practical value.
If we know that species A has an important chemical in that might be anti-HIV or anti-cancer, then its sister species, as we would call it, or the most closely related species, species B, is more likely to have that chemical in it than a less related species. So we can now start to look at that tree of life, at the species in general, and say, if you want to go and look for a chemical that possibly could be useful to humankind, that's where you ought to go looking. So the level of predictivity is really important. We can do lots of other things when we know about phylogenetic relationships. We can look at the evolution of plant characters. We can look at evolution of traits. We can look at groups that are nitrogen fixing and say anything in that group that hasn't been studied in detail in terms of its nitrogen fixing might be a nitrogen fixer because it's in that clade. So all those levels of helping humankind in terms of agriculture, where we go looking for things chemically, medicines, etc., etc. It's very, very important to understand relationships.
Nature loves patterns. The same shapes are repeated at all sorts of scales. Like so much else in botanical science, the classification of the evolutionary relationships of plants from their DNA is a profoundly important scientific resource and a thing of elegance and beauty in its own right, a molecular tree of trees. And patterns from DNA were to shed light on one group of plants that has intrigue in both shape and molecular form, the palm, and its place in our present-day tropical rainforest.
Dynamic rainforest.
In 2007, an extraordinary new find came to light in the plant kingdom. A French plantation manager, Xavier Metz, was walking with family in remote Madagascar when he came across what appeared to be a completely unknown species of palm tree. Samples were sent here to Kew Gardens. Metz was right. It turned out to be entirely possible for an 18-metre monster with a 5-metre leaf span and flowers like gigantic yellow candelabras to flourish in the wild without science knowing about it. Kew's head of palms at the time, John Dransfield, takes up the story.
Everything went mad. People were astonished. And Xavier also then looked in Google Earth and the resolution for Google Earth for that bit of Madagascar is unusually good.
So you could see the palm?
And you can see the palm. So the next thing that happened was that our close colleague, my ex-PhD student, Mitsuru Rakutuarinive, he went and made the collections. And I can remember immense excitement that he came to stay for Easter and he brought the sample with him. And we opened it up in the garden, and I looked at this thing, and I said immediately, it's a member of the Tuniofenaceae, which means that its closest relatives are a palm called Nanorops that grows in Afghanistan, another genus called Caryodoxa, which occurs in Thailand on the island of Phuket, and another palm of two species, Tuniofenix, in Hainan and Vietnam.
So how on earth do you have a palm in Madagascar that has those links across in an evolutionary sense? It's
extraordinary. I wish I could explain it. Morphologically, there was absolutely no doubt at all in my mind that these had to be closely related. Yeah. The four different genera are widely, almost wildly different from each other in general form, but the flower structure and fruit structure is all pretty congruent.
And what about the molecular phylogeny?
Molecular data completely supported its position there.
The new palm was named after one of Metz's daughters, Tahina, which is also a Magalese word meaning to be blessed, and spectabilis, a Latin word which can mean not just remarkable, but also gaudy, showy and conspicuous, all entirely appropriate epithets for this colourful giant. Tahina spectabilis is just one of a long line of palms identified by Kew since the 1980s. Palms provide many basic necessities. They are collectively one of the most economically important plant families after grasses and legumes. Cataloguing the different types of palms, as new species make themselves known to science, to appreciate their potential uses is therefore important. When the so-called palm Bible Genera Pomarum was in press in 2007, Tahina spectabilis had only just been discovered. It was hurriedly added to the book at the last minute, and the range of known species continues to grow. Bill Baker is head of palm research at Kew.
We're focusing on New Guinea at the moment because that is such an inaccessible place. We've worked for years to build up good relationships in New Guinea, which mean that we can now go and do great collaborative field work there. And the things that we find there every field trip, genuine novelties at the species and at the generic level. So, for example, I've just published 15 new species of rattan, single genus Calamus, from New Guinea. I've got another 10 to write up when I find the time. There's so much out there still appearing, but that island is under intensifying threat. So one is also saddened by the fact that pretty much everything you discover and describe as new is also endangered.
But incredibly excited to be finding all these new species all the time.
When I first started doing this, I found I couldn't sleep at night after realising something was new. It's just such a thrill.
And it's in here, in Kew's Palm House, that we have a living library, a museum of life documenting new classifications which add to our understanding of the history of the family and their distribution around the world. As you may have heard in a previous episode, advances in the use of genetic tools for classifying flowering plants lie at the heart of huge strides in our understanding of the evolutionary relationships between plants. And the palm family is no exception. Research at Kew means that we can now give each new find its rightful place in the burgeoning tree of life based on their molecular characteristics apparent in their DNA. This research has suggested that there are 5 evolutionary lineages and has also produced some surprises. Bill Baker.
We confirmed some aspects of old-fashioned taxonomy, which is always reassuring, but there were some real shockers. So in front of us we have a Caryota, which has a very weird, doubly pinnate leaf with funny fishtail leaflets, standing above Caryodoxa, which is a really fantastic fan palm from Thailand. And I brought this just to illustrate the fact that when we did all this DNA work on palms, here you have a great example of the fan palms. This Caryodoxa here has epically beautiful, perfect, rounded fan-shaped leaf, and yet above it this slightly scruffy fishtail palm. It's hard to believe that that fishtail palm is pretty closely related to this fan palm here. And some of those findings were really unexpected and turned our concepts of palm classification on their head.
So if you classified them according to leaf shape, then you put them into one group, but then when you looked at their molecular characteristics, they're not so close, is that correct?
Exactly. The morphology of palms is positively misleading and doesn't necessarily reflect, if you look at the wrong character, it doesn't necessarily reflect the history underpinning that group.
In looking at the history of palms, DNA sequences are themselves an amazing evolutionary record. They show mutations that have accumulated in genomes over millions of years. In a sense, a molecular fossil record. One of the principal advantages of genetic analysis is the length of the timescales involved. Looking at living specimens or examples from field collections gives you only a very recent history, a snapshot in time. Even fossils only get you so far, and there is also bias in the record depending on the preservation conditions at the time of burial and the potential of the plant to become fossilised. Some plants are much more suitable for fossilisation than others. Genetic analysis, therefore, provides an additional window into evolution over much longer timescales and, crucially, begins to show when diversification of palms occurred.
We can do clever things with DNA trees nowadays, a bit of smoke and mirrors, and using complex analysis and being informed by the fossil record, we can try and estimate a date for the diversification of the palms. And we think the current extant, the living lineages of palms that we see today, started to diversify about 100 million years ago. So that's the middle, about the middle of the Cretaceous. And because they have this very strong relationship with rainforests, 90-95% of all palms occur in rainforests. That's led us on to wonder, well, if we have a really good evolutionary tree for the palms, what can we get out of that in terms of insights into the evolution of rainforest itself? One of the things that first hit us is that if palms have always been conserved to occur in the rainforest, they diversified 100 million years ago, and yet the really robust fossil evidence for angiosperm-dominated rainforests such as we know today doesn't really kick in till after the end of the Cretaceous, 55, 65 million years ago. And yet our evidence seems to suggest that palms were diversifying in a rainforest-like environment 100 million years ago.
This 40 million year difference in what the molecular record suggests as the earliest diversification of palms and what the fossil record indicates is just one of a number of conundrums that have been thrown up by analysing the DNA fingerprint. Another key question that botanists have long wondered is how rainforests became so rich in species. They are, after all, the most plant species rich areas on the planet. Charles Darwin's contemporary Alfred Russel Wallace suggested in his Tropical Nature and Other Essays of 1878, the great mass of equatorial forests must have benefited from consistent climatic conditions over time, whereas Earth's temperate areas had experienced periodic checks and extinctions.
In one, evolution has had a fair chance. In the other, it has had countless difficulties thrown in its way. The equatorial regions are then, as regards their past and present life history, a more ancient world than that represented by the temperate zones, a world in which the laws that have governed the progressive development of life have operated with comparatively little check for countless ages and have resulted in these infinitely varied and beautiful forms.
This is now known as the museum model of evolution, where it's argued that constant climatic conditions and stability over time allows genetic variations to accumulate, leading to greater species richness in these regions. So what does the genetic evidence suggest?
The exciting thing about having a good evolutionary tree is not only can you get absolute dates on events, but you can also look at trajectories. And what we found in the palms is that the diversity of palm lineages accumulated in a very steady rate over time, at least up until the Miocene about 20 million years ago. And that's exciting because most of the molecular evidence is pointing us to sort of glitzy, recent rapid radiations. And also we know that rainforests are dynamic places and there's a lot of disturbance and turnover over time. And yet our evidence matches the so-called museum model. Diversity can evolve and build over time. So to find out that palms conform to that, the quintessential tropical family conform to that model, at least at this deep level, was so extremely exciting. But we haven't yet looked at the tips of the tree of life. We haven't got into the species level details. So I suspect once we start looking, as we are at the moment, for example, at the radiation of palms in Madagascar, we'll start to see some of those explosive, rapid periods of diversification happening in more recent timeframes.
Food, timber, medicines, and writing materials have all been derived from palms. And the more we know about them, the more useful they become. And the more we understand the need to protect and nurture them for their benefit and ours. So next, we turn to the services plants offer, in effect the natural capital of plants. Which plant biodiversity is most useful to humankind, both now and in the future? And which bits should we conserve? And where?
Capture and drawdown.
...2010 was declared the International Year of Biodiversity. In this year, a study was undertaken in which UK citizens were asked to define the word biodiversity. The results were rather surprising. Not least that the most common answer was that biodiversity was some kind of washing powder. Clearly this isn't the correct definition. In fact, biodiversity is the term used to describe all aspects of biological diversity, from genes through to populations, communities, and whole ecosystems. But given the global challenges that we face in terms of climate change, a growing population, urbanisation, food and fuel security, it's perhaps understandable that many of us don't appreciate the term biodiversity. And even if we do, we then question whether biodiversity is a luxury we can no longer afford. It's the so what question. Why should we conserve biodiversity? Perhaps the answer lies in properly assessing how biodiversity serves our livelihoods and well-being. It's an approach that's starting to move up the political agenda globally. Take, for example, the United Nations Global Outlook report in 2008.
Biodiversity plays fundamental roles in maintaining and enhancing the well-being of the world's more than 6.7 billion people, rich and poor, rural and urban alike.
So, in effect, it's an approach that suggests we value biodiversity according to its contribution to humankind, so-called ecosystem services. It's a radical departure from the protected area model for biodiversity conservation, where landscapes with the highest concentration of biodiversity are conserved. Just imagine a photo of a landscape with a patch of forest to one side, fields in the middle, trees around the field margins, and mountains in the background. In a traditional protected area categorisation, you would probably place your protected area fence around the forest on the basis that this almost certainly is the most species-rich part of the landscape. But if we're assessing the biodiversity of this landscape in terms of the services that it provides to livelihoods and well-being, the forest now represents an important regulating service for drawing down carbon dioxide. The trees around the edge of the field are important for nesting habitats for pollinators. The fields themselves are important for providing crops, and the mountains for recreation and mental well-being. So the landscape becomes partitioned in a very different way. It's a new approach to biodiversity conservation that was first highlighted in a landmark study called the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment in 2005, in which the "so what" question becomes two very different lines of inquiry. First, what aspects of biodiversity are the most important to conserve for the ecosystem services that they provide? And second, where are these located? As our series draws to a close, I'm going to be examining these questions and the research currently being undertaken to determine the true natural capital of plants. One of the biggest environmental risks facing humankind today is climate change. Much of this is being driven by increasing atmospheric carbon dioxide, which is now at 400 parts per million volume. Put into context, this is approximately a third higher than any other time in the past 800,000 years, the longest time that we've had good records of atmospheric carbon dioxide. Leaving aside the cause of this increase, we urgently need to find mechanisms to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And this is where plants come in. Trees are some of the most effective organisms at drawing down atmospheric carbon dioxide. Their essential role in regulating the atmosphere has been known for a long time. But which trees are best at doing this, and where? Two questions I put to Yavinda Marley, Professor of Terrestrial Ecosystems in the Environmental Change Institute at the University of Oxford. Yavinda runs a large global tree monitoring network for tropical sites across South America, Africa and Southeast Asia.
The tropical forests play a huge role because they are amongst the most productive ecosystems on Earth. So about 40 to 50% of the carbon that flows through the biosphere passes through the tropical biosphere, the rainforest biosphere. And also because they sit on the equator, that's where all the energy is. So that's where the forests affect the amount of water cycling back to the atmosphere, the energy balance of the Earth and the global climate. So they really are engines of global climate.
Which are the most important trees, would you say? I presume they're tropical trees that draw down CO2.
The ideal tree for drawing down CO2 is something that grows fast but then lives for a long time and locks in that carbon and holds it for centuries or millennia. And the tropics tend to have that combination. The other trees, such as the redwoods all in California, are also important in that respect. But in the tropics, you know, one example would be something like a Brazil nut tree, which is well known across the Amazon, that's going to live for centuries. There are similar types of species across the Congo and others, things that stay on for centuries despite growing quite quickly.
Estimates suggest that between 2000 and 2007, the global forest carbon sink pulled down from the atmosphere a staggering 2.5 billion tonnes of carbon a year. Globally, the tropical forests pull down the most atmospheric carbon dioxide, followed by temperate forests and then boreal forests. Interestingly, however, tropical forests that are recovering from past deforestation and logging provide the largest sink, accounting for up to 1.7 billion tonnes of carbon drawdown a year.
They're the ones that can really accumulate carbon if they're left to persist for a long time. In the tropics, we tend to view landscapes that are deforested as somehow lost, as somehow they've lost their virginity or their pristineness. And actually, that's the wrong view. These are landscapes of incredible potential and resilience.
So that's quite surprising then. So you're saying that I'd always thought, you know, it's the mature forest there, the real carbon sink.
It shows the importance of also putting attention to second growth forests, things that are recovering. I wouldn't detract from the importance of the primary forests.
Absolutely,
they have huge in value as carbon stores.
Yeah.
But often we can neglect what is almost a disparaging term, the secondary forest, forget that these have huge value in terms of the ecosystem services and the biodiversity they can host. And actually, a significant part of our carbon sink can be in, the term I prefer now is second growth.
So all is not lost with your cleared tropical forest, as long as you leave it long enough to recover.
Certainly, and I think degraded can be an often misused term. It sometimes implies worthless.
Yes.
But actually, these forests are full of huge potential.
But what about urban landscapes? Do trees, including those that provide street furniture in so many towns and city landscapes, make any difference whatsoever to the carbon budget? A recent study estimates that the carbon drawdown of street trees in US cities results in an annual carbon drawdown of approximately 25.6 million tons a year. Small but significant, especially to the city dwellers who sit under them with their lunchtime sandwich and breathe the air they help regulate. And how good is Kew at sucking carbon dioxide out of London's air? There are 14,000 trees here. How do they score? Even in this small corner of West London, the trees provide an estimated drawdown of 8.6 tonnes of carbon dioxide per year. Not bad. But new research is also suggesting that in addition to the regulation of global carbon budgets, trees could also be extremely important in regulating global water circulation.
If you have an area, say a deforested area and a cattle ranch in the Amazon, without trees, when rain comes down, it enters the soil and then it ends up in the groundwater and out in the rivers and disappears to the ocean. When you have trees, you have something with deeper roots that can still tap into the moisture in the soil and pull it back up into the atmosphere and recycle that moisture. And it's been estimated that around half or three quarters of the rainfall that falls in the Amazon basin comes through this recycling of water through the trees. And that matters not only for rainfall, it matters for cloud formation. And the clouds directly affect climate by changing the reflectivity of the Earth's surface and reflecting more light back into the space, and that has a strong local cooling effect. And as the clouds form above the tropics, they release heat into the upper atmosphere, and that is one of the main engines of the global atmospheric circulation. So changes in forest cover and cloud cover in the Amazon can end up affecting rainfall in Europe and Central Asia through these large-scale connections.
So we can regulate atmospheric carbon dioxide by understanding which trees absorb it most efficiently and where, and we can even influence rainfall patterns in Europe and Asia by how we treat tropical rainforest. These examples represent just a tiny fraction of the natural capital of plants in regulating Earth's systems. But in evaluating biodiversity this way, it's important not to forget the other aspects of well-being that benefit from biodiversity, the sheer beauty of it and the aesthetic benefits it provides. In other words, its cultural services.
Green and pleasant lands.
With the ever-increasing pressure on land for food, fuel, urbanisation and population growth, landscapes that are often most at risk of threat are the small pockets of green, be they copses surrounded by fields of crops, green sites surrounding the edges of towns and cities, or village greens and public gardens. These can be seen on satellite imagery all over the world. They often represent small islands within vast areas of urban or agricultural sprawl. The reason for their existence is often a legacy of the past. Often, but not always, these areas are relatively poor in biodiversity. If they're a dedicated wildlife reserve, for example, they may be managed for just a few iconic species or a particular type of landscape. So when we're thinking about biodiversity and the ecosystem services that these landscapes provide, is there any value in them? And when it comes to deciding which landscapes to convert for other uses, should these be at the top of the list? Controversial stuff, but something we all need to address, given that most of us, the world over, will have run-ins with planning officers on this very topic sometime in our lives. Of what value are these landscapes and the plants they contain? Take the botanical gardens here at Kew. Richard Barley is the director of horticulture and has been considering the place of green spaces like these in society.
Really, the role of a modern botanic garden, I think, is an amalgam of a range of things, from scientific work on plants, conservation of plants, building public understanding about plants, but also providing a physical space in which people can relax, enjoy, admire the beauty of plants and landscapes, and learn and build their own understanding. So it's really a rather lovely combination of factors that almost open up more and more the more you look at them.
But this combination hasn't always lived in Sylvian harmony. Joseph Hooker, Kew's famously tetchy director in the latter half of the 19th century expressed serious concerns about the recreational use of the gardens.
Its primary objects are scientific and utilitarian, not recreational. This is no place for mere pleasure or recreational seekers whose motives are rude romping and games.
No wonder Darwin described his friend Hooker as impulsive and somewhat peppery in temper. Historian Jim Endersby takes up the story.
In the 1870s, one of the gardening magazines published a cartoon which showed the high wall around Kew, the public in great crowds excluded, and inside a handful of botanists wandering around examining plants. And they complained that Kew had been treated almost like a private garden, a happy hunting ground for various scientifically inclined members of the Hooker family, and that the public, far from being satisfied, as Hooker claimed, were in fact excluded. So there was a good deal of tension, and it really came to a head when the railway got here. Lots of people came down on the new trains to Kew, expecting to be able to enjoy the gardens, and found that they were actually shut until lunchtime, so that the scientifically inclined members of the Hooker family and friends could enjoy a little research in peace and quiet. The British public, being the British public, took themselves off to the pub, relaxed and enjoyed themselves until the gardens opened. And it was, I suspect, the sight of people passing out in the shrubberies in a drunken stupor that persuaded Hooker that perhaps opening early and even opening a tea shop might be the lesser of the available evils.
On a more sober note, as well as providing a source of inspiration and recreation, there's plenty of research evidence linking the value of green spaces to mental well-being. For a long time, there's been anecdotal evidence to suggest that green spaces can make positive contributions to our health, help with stress, boost our natural defences, and help us to concentrate. But is there any science to support this anecdotal evidence? And what type of green space and associated biodiversity do we need? For example, is there a difference between walking on a golf course, forest, or moorlands? We also don't know about the state of that green space. Does it have less of a health benefit if it is degraded? In response to these questions, Rachel Bragg, who is the Deputy Director of the Sustainability Institute at Essex University, has been undertaking research to assess the mental health benefits when exercising in different landscapes.
We had some people looking at beautiful urban scenes, beautiful countryside or countryside that had been polluted in some way, and obviously a control group that just looked at a blank wall while they ran or walked on a treadmill. Certainly for all the groups, exercising on the treadmill made them feel a bit better, but the groups that were looking at the more beautiful rural scenes and the beautiful urban scenes felt much better. We looked at blood pressure, we looked at self-esteem, we looked at mood, and we found drops in blood pressure, which was interesting, and obviously exercise has an effect anyway. But something we did find that quite surprised us is that people who were looking at certainly the polluted countryside photos started to feel worse, actually, than if they were looking at a blank wall.
The results achieved in these experiments are now being translated into practice. So-called green care is becoming an increasingly established part of all sorts of therapeutic and social programmes. Prisons and hospitals alike now have gardens. Plants and the landscapes they provide are an essential part of this cultural service.
We found that people who started off with lower mental health, if you like, or perhaps weren't so well, seemed to find the bigger improvements having spent time in nature. So that led us to look into specific nature interventions that work with different vulnerable groups of people to see what the effects that was having. And depending on the client group and the improvements that they're seeking, we have found right across the board improvements to mental health and to how people feel about themselves. We've found a sort of a reduction in feeling isolated. A lot of these interventions are group interventions. And so people ask all the time, well, is it the nature or is it the being with other people or is it the activities? Is it being really engaged with nature that does it? And I think that it's a combination of all of these factors all working together to have these wide-ranging benefits.
Along with aspects of mental well-being and spirituality, it's long been acknowledged that connectedness to nature also provides educational benefits. Even Kew's Joseph Hooker had to rather begrudgingly acknowledge that an apparent gradual improvement in visitor behaviour here in the gardens was due to
the natural beauties of the place and the evidence of system and order with which the visitors are confronted when entering the gates, and the proof these afford of the solicitude of Parliament and the public that everything should be well-ordered and attractive, as well as instructional and scientific.
And gardens and green landscapes are still providing this important educational service. But there is a fine line between education in a strict sense and learning through nature. And all of us probably have experienced at some time of being dragged around a dusty museum or botanical garden with clipboard in hand. At Kew, we now have 100,000 schoolchildren through the gates each year, along with 1.3 million other visitors. So how do we link this role of beauty, biodiversity and environmental education?
Creating interesting plantings is about weaving together those threads of colour, form and texture in ways that are intriguing. But the components of that, I think, need to tell a story, need to be significant in one way or another. For Kew as a botanic garden, given that people are more likely and more used to seeing plants growing in parks and gardens, they perhaps take them for granted. And so our challenge, I think, is to coax them into questioning things. So after they leave Kew, if they're walking down the road and they look at a tree or a shrub or some annuals and they think, now what's going on there? What's that? Why is it growing like that? I think then we've had a small victory.
Inspiration in nature can come in many forms, from the 250-year-old cycad tree in the palm house to spectacular complex displays. Here at Kew, there are plans to redesign the main pedestrian spine. Its new borders at 330 metres will be possibly the longest herbaceous borders in the world.
That will take several truckloads of plants, I can assure you. We will propagate a lot of the material here. At Kew, we have quite significant quantities of plants that are held in our living collections out of public view. And one of my objectives through doing this is to see what we can actually bring into the public realm, particularly in our main pedestrian areas, because these were designed for people to walk slowly and admire the beauty of plantings on either side of the path. Beauty can catch people's attention, and then using plants that have other stories we can tell, we can add the other layers.
Recreation, health, spirituality, and education, they're all part of the cultural services that we get from nature. And although some of this might appear a little tree-hugging and unscientific, the influence of these on our desire to conserve biodiversity cannot be underestimated. Whilst the types of landscape and their management vary widely, from neatly manicured botanical gardens like Kew to unmanaged wilderness, even the wildest places often bear the imprint of past human activity. For example, in the UK and Europe, many are the direct result of historic farming activity, whether it's the axe, the plough, or the scythe. And many of the plants that thrive in them need human disturbance to allow them to germinate. Think of how poppies spring up when a field has been ploughed or a hedgerow cleared, or, most movingly, when the battlefields of northern France were laid waste by shelling a century ago. And it's this mosaic of open landscapes that we turn to next, and understanding the role of biodiversity in providing us with resilient crops for the future.
The Great Providers.
What's biodiversity worth? In earlier programmes, we've looked at this question in terms of the plants needed for regulating Earth's ecosystems. We've also looked at the importance of green landscapes, parks and gardens for our well-being and recreation. But probably closest to all of our hearts and stomachs is understanding the plant biodiversity that we need in order to provide food, clothing, fuel, drugs and a vast variety of other commodities. Looking for plants for these so-called provisioning services lay at the very foundation of Kew's original scientific goals and its first patron, historian Jim Endersby.
If Joseph Banks were able to come back and have a look round Kew today and see what's going on, quite a lot of it would seem familiar to him. Certainly the idea that we need these resources for 1,001 different reasons, the idea that gardens are beautiful and should be created and preserved for that reason, all these things would have been very familiar to the 18th century, to people like Banks. To finalise that vision that he had of a great botanical exchange house for the empire. But Kew now sees itself as a partner to all the other botanic gardens in the world, not as a dominating centre of empire. It's not about what Britain needs in terms of plant resources, it's about what the world needs.
So understanding the distribution, diversity and potential of plants for food, fuel and drugs was and still is a central part of Kew's scientific mission. But whereas the earliest expeditions of Banks and Hooker were mainly focused on finding the best plants, either in yield, taste or ability to reduce fever, we have to thank another botanist for promoting the need to conserve a different aspect of biodiversity to mitigate against plant disease and climate change. It was the Russian botanist Nikolai Vavilov who, as we've already heard, recognised the importance of finding the closest wild relatives to many of our staple crops, be it cereals, legumes, vegetables or fibre-producing plants. His vision was profound and required not just an understanding of the location of the best crops, but also identification and distribution of their closest wild relatives. Vavilov would, I hope, be relieved to see that his vision flourishes in seed banking all around the world. What would probably shock him, however, is how valuable, in monetary terms, the natural capital of crop wild relatives, or CWRs, are now. In a landmark study, Richard Thompson from the global accounting firm PricewaterhouseCooper made a preliminary calculation of the monetary value of genetically diverse plants, which are the wild relatives of our modern crops.
We gathered as much data we could to demonstrate what was the yield improvement from using CWRs. And then we translated that, in effect, into a big financial model, which says the impact on yield is X. And then we were building up a set of assumptions in order to try and identify exactly what proportion of the yield improvement that is observed was attributable to the use of the CWR trait within the crop. And then we converted that into dollars in terms of benefit to production at the factory gate.
So which crops were you looking at?
Well, we looked at three crops to begin with: wheat, rice and potatoes. We picked those crops because those are crops that are grown globally, and we also picked those because there was a fair amount of research already in terms of the impact that the use of CWRs had on yield to those crops. And then we extrapolated our results across all crops that use CWRs, which gave us the total benefit of $200
billion. $200 billion sounds like a huge figure. But it's not just the insurance value that these species provide if the cultivated crop fails, but also the substantial benefits of CWRs in increasing agricultural yield.
If you look at potatoes, for example, which are one of the crops that we looked at in detail, potato blight is a big issue for potatoes. And actually the use of CWRs has lots of studies which show that it reduces the impact of potato blight by up to 30%. So, i.e., that is, you get a 30% benefit in yield on potatoes through using certain strains of CWR. So, of course, when you look at that across the whole supply chain, the dollar amount can be very substantial.
Should we be putting an economic value on other forms of nature, do you think, in this way?
Well, I think a study like this is very important, because unless you're able to put an economic benefit, it's very difficult to actually get private investment if we need to develop it without understanding what the true benefit or indeed what the cost is of not taking action. So I think actually putting a number on it is vital.
But to really ensure resilience to current and future climate and disease, we also need to know how different species are going to respond. And this is where scientific research on crop wild relatives is now heading. Once armed with the knowledge of the different species and their distribution in the wild, you then have the ability, through mapping this against current climatic variables, temperature and rainfall, to create a model of ideal conditions for each species. This type of modelling approach to crop wild relatives is being carried out here at Kew by taxonomist Aaron Davis. He's working on a crop which many of you may be drinking right now, coffee. Globally, coffee is the second most important commodity after oil and supports 25 million farming families worldwide. There are known to be about 125 species in the wild, but we drink only one, Coffee arabica, which originated from Ethiopia
and is now distributed around the world. But how threatened is it from current and future climate change?
Well, we did an analysis back in 2012. The sort of take home from that was that if we don't do anything now and over the next 20 years, by the end of the century, wild Arabica in Ethiopia could be extinct. That's in the worst case scenario.
So how did you work that out then?
We did a modelling exercise, computer modelling, to predict forward through the century, 2020, 2050, 2080, to see what the suitability would be like. And what we see is the climate in many parts of Ethiopia will not be suitable. Of course, there's regional climate change caused by deforestation and land use change, market factors. The value chain has to be factored in because it's not necessarily the extreme temperatures or drought that will kill coffee. It will be the influence of environmental factors on quality. And if farmers can't get a good price for their coffee, then they simply won't grow it.
Coffee Arabica therefore appears to be a sensitive species. Change the temperature by a few degrees, and worryingly, both the taste and health of the plant is affected. Using this modelling approach, combined with predicted future climatic scenarios, means that we can then develop strategies to try and sustain our current global coffee crop.
What we're doing here at Kew is producing a very accurate map, down to 5 metre resolution, across Ethiopia, looking at which areas are vulnerable and which communities are vulnerable to climate change, and then targeting resources to those communities to enable them to best adapt to a changing climate.
So will they adapt to a different species of coffee or a different crop?
So you have a scaled range of scenarios. If you have, let's say, a half degree increase in temperature, you can do certain things on the farm, such as increase the shade, use mulches. When you start pushing beyond, say, a degree, then you need to start thinking of something a bit more drastic. So you might relocate and advise farmers to actually grow something different. What we're also looking at here is which species could we use either as a single crop or in breeding programs to give resilience beyond, say, 2 degrees.
And have you identified those species yet?
We're working on it. We have a number of candidate species which were used as minor crops at the early part of the 20th century, which could have potential.
So are those growing in really dry environments right now then, those species?
Yes, some of them grow in very dry environments. Some of them have a long period of stress during the dry season. But some of the information we have at Kew from our archives indicates that actually these species have a good taste. And that's important. And it's something that wasn't really factored into some of the earlier breeding studies, is that you can breed for resilience, but if the beverage of coffee doesn't taste good, yeah, then nobody will want to buy it.
So there's some jars here I see from the Economic Botany Collection. This looks like peanuts, but I presume it's not. What's in that one?
This is interesting. This is the lowland coffee of Sierra Leone. This coffee is a washed coffee. That means it's been pulped and
so
dried.
It's the light colour.
It's very light colour. Yeah. It's about the same size as Arabica. But according to our archival data and information, this coffee has a better flavour than Arabica coffee. It got a very high acclaim by the French and by the English as a superb coffee. And this is one of the coffees we're going to try and revisit to see what potential it has.
Coffee and knowledge of their wild crop relatives shows just how important plant intelligence is at the ecological level. But if we're to address the global challenge of a growing population and food security, we still need to be seeking out new food crops. A task that has echoes of what our founders at Kew were doing, plant hunting. And emerging evidence suggests that in some cases, important future crops are still to be found from previously overlooked plants. Paul Wilkin, a taxonomist based in the herbarium here at Kew, is working on one such example.
If you look at the cultivation of something like maize, for example, in eastern or southern Africa, it's quite marginal. If the rain doesn't come at a certain time, the maize crop simply won't arrive, whereas yams are pre-adapted to that kind of climate and fare much better. That means that if we get climatic fluctuations and climate change and so on, yams are a much better bet, statistically speaking, than something like a cereal crop would be.
There are over 50 varieties of edible yams across the tropics, and there are two cultivars, Guinea yams and winged yams. At the moment, this tuber crop doesn't get the full attention of the world's financial systems. I've never knowingly eaten yams, and I'm told they might not be everyone's preferred food, but they may well provide an essential backup crop for ensuring everyone has something to eat in regions of the world that are increasingly seeing challenges in the face of climate change.
The work on yams also illustrates one final aspect of biodiversity that we must conserve if we are to build resilience into our ecosystems, and that is genetic diversity. Genetic diversity at the level of the individual species, within populations, across species ranges, and resulting from millions of years of evolutionary processes, is our ultimate get-out-of-jail card when faced with the need for resilient ecosystems. Without this genetic library, we have little future. We've known about the benefits of diversity and genetic crossing since the days of Mendel and his peas, and as Paul Wilkin explains, even the simple crossing of cultivated crops such as yams with wild varieties could provide great potential for the future.
Conventional cultivated yams could be improved by bringing in genes from the wild yams to give desirable traits to the yams. So one of the disadvantages of yams is they're climbing plants and you have to grow them on stakes. People are looking very intensively now at how one might be able to have stake-free yam cultivation. So if you could get a gene from a wild yam which didn't climb, and there are a few of those species, into the cultivated species, that would enable us to enhance yam cultivation quite extensively. And because we know more or less what the relatives are of the Guinea yams and of the important winged yams of Asia, we'll certainly be able to use those, I would hope, as sources of genes to develop the traits that are needed for the plant breeders.
A leading scientist once said that the important thing is not simply to accumulate facts, but to ask challenging questions and to seek to answer them. We began this series with Linnaeus and a new rigour in the scientific study of botany to get agreed names for all living species, to Banks and Hooker understanding what grows where and why, and on to Mendel with his peas and Vavilov with his crop wild relatives. Over the last 250 years, these scientists and many more like them have demonstrated that plants can and will provide at least some of the solutions to the global challenges we are facing today. The terminology and scale may have changed, and our understanding of plants, their genomes, molecular compounds, and physiological functioning has certainly changed. But it's remarkable how many of the questions scientists were asking 2.5 centuries ago we're still addressing today. And we need those answers from plants more now than ever before. Plants matter.
Plants from Roots to Riches was presented by Professor Kathy Willis. The reader was Clive Hayward. The series was produced by Adrian Washbourne. Now, just before the World Tonight, a look at tomorrow's weather. And it'll be a dry and bright start for most of the UK, but a squally spell of rain will move northeastwards across England, Wales and probably southern Scotland around the middle of the day. It'll be brighter elsewhere with a few showers, but parts of Northern Ireland and northeastern Scotland should have a mostly dry day. And the outlook for Sunday and Monday, much of the UK will be fine on Sunday with lighter winds and a few showers, these mainly affecting coastal areas. However, wet and windy weather will make its way eastwards across the UK on Monday. Temperatures will stay around average. And that's the weather forecast. On 92 to 95 FM, 198 Longwave, and on digital radio, this is BBC Radio 4.